This year marks the 100th anniversary of Einstein's theory of general relativity. That's something to celebrate. But you know, Einstein wasn't foolproof. In fact, there are some things he got wrong or just refused to accept. For instance, quantum entanglement. One of the most bizarre properties of subatomic particles is that they seem able to pair off and stay connected even when they're on opposite sides of the universe. Now, Einstein hated this whole idea. He called it spooky action at a distance. But just a couple of weeks ago, a team of scientists in the Netherlands seemed to prove it once and for all. So what exactly does it mean for two particles to be entangled? Science writer George Musser explains.
Yeah, I mean, the word sounds like they're like a ball of yarn, mm-hmm. and they're just kind of entangled, like a kindergartner's shoelaces can never be disentangled. But it's more subtle. It's more like a romantic entanglement, something that's an interesting but awkward relationship. And so these particles, as you say, that can come together, interact, and then separate again, retain this linkage, this bond.
One of the freakiest experiments I read about was, it's one somebody can demonstrate, I think people can even demonstrate it in the basement if you've got the right equipment, where you describe it as a kind of coin flip thing, except where you're flipping subatomic particles. And every time you flip them, the ones that are entangled, they both come out exactly the same, either heads or tails.
Exactly. So thinking of them as magic coins is really a very good way of doing this. And this goes back to a basic property of quantum mechanics in the quantum world, the subatomic strange world, is that it's random. So you measure the particle and it, say, might be this thing or that thing, 50-50. So it acts like a coin.
Heads or tails.
Exactly. So what's called heads or tails. So it means that if you flip the one on the left, it comes up heads, let's say. The one on the right comes up heads. You flip the one on the left, it comes up tails. The right one comes up tails.
Always? Forever?
Always. Yes.
And does it matter how far apart they are? I mean, does the effect get weaker with distance?
The effect does not weaken with distance. They could be a finger's width apart. They could be a planet width apart. They could be the entire universe apart. And they are still acting in synchrony. Isn't it weird?
It is. Well, frankly, it sounds like magic. I mean, something out of Harry Potter.
It's totally something like magic. In fact, it's actually, physicists have called it, this is the closest thing to magic that we know. Now, it's unlike Harry Potter. In fact, if Harry Potter did this, he'd fail his owls. Snape would throw him out of Hogwarts because the magic is extremely subtle. If you look on its own, just look at that one coin, you would just see heads or tails. It just looks like an ordinary coin. If you look at the other coin, heads, tails, ordinary coin. It's only when you compare them, you notice this kind of synchronicity that they have. So you couldn't use it to, you know, apparate or do any of the things that they do in Harry Potter because it's too subtle for that.
Hmm. You also tell a story about a guy who teaches at Colgate University, teaches college students, and manages to do this just in the college laboratory, right?
Enrique Galvis, who's up at Colgate, figured that actually the technology now is just good enough. And it's really coming out of the telecoms industry that uses fiber optics. It's coming out of DVD players that use lasers in them. And you can actually just repurpose those lasers for your experiments. You can kind of just salvage. You can go to the Best Buy and just buy a player and just take it apart and use the laser. Almost they do that almost literally.
Wait, are you saying that I could just go to Best Buy, get some equipment, and then entangle some subatomic particles in my basement?
You could. You could. I've actually done it, but not using Best Buy or you know, DVD-grade lasers. I actually did it using gamma rays that I bought. I actually bought online. You can do this. Internet's an amazing thing. You can actually buy radioactive materials in very small quantities that they're safe online. And in some cases, the isotopes will actually give out entangled particles. So actually, I did that in my basement.
Wow.
So anyway, and Enrique did this, and he was really the first person to do it at the level of just – and a freshman could do it in college.
So there's another thing that makes this whole concept so hard to grasp, and that's the principle of non-locality. I mean, doesn't entanglement go against everything we think we know about how things in the physical world, real world things, interact with each other?
Exactly. So, example, a particle and another particle. The two particles are affecting each other. How do they do that? Our understanding of most of physics is they interact by sending a wave that passes from one to the other. Or maybe they just literally get up from one position and go to the other position and knock into the other particle. So they just make contact. Entanglement, quantum non-locality violates this idea. These particles are somehow acting in a unified way despite the distance between them. In fact, they're insensitive to distance. That's what's weird. They're not acting spatially.
But is the corollary of that that space itself is an illusion?
Well, actually, yeah, that seems to be the thinking nowadays. I mean, so to you and me and to all of the creatures that inhabit space, space is quite real. The question is what's happening at a deeper level. And at a deeper level, space may not really be there. The distance may not really be there. So when we're apart from our loved ones, that's difficult, and there's a distance that separates us. But in a sense, we're actually not apart from them. There's no distance between us. We're still right together with one another.
So why have physicists been so reluctant to talk about quantum entanglement and non-locality? I mean, is it just that it just doesn't fit the rest of their science?
One thing is that there was an intense debate, really, in the late 20s, early 30s over the meaning of quantum theory. Everyone was engaged in Heisenberg, Bohr, Einstein, Schrödinger, all these great pioneers of quantum physics. But they kind of burned out on it, essentially. They got to a point where, like, oh, God, do we have to debate this anymore? Let's just do something with this theory. Let's apply it. So they started applying it to light. They started applying it to what later became known as the strong and weak nuclear force. So they essentially moved from this discussion mode, this philosophical mode, into more of a pragmatic mode. And then uses arose for it. People showed it could be used for cryptography. It could be used for aiding communications. It could be used for quantum computers, potentially.
Right. And as soon as anybody who uses a cell phone has reason to be grateful for quantum physics.
Exactly. And as soon as you show someone it's useful, you know, all their misgivings kind of become moot at that point.
Well, I'm still really fascinated about what it might tell us or suggest about the nature of reality that is maybe counterintuitive or not what we've been told. For instance, it makes me wonder what can be entangled. I mean, I'm made of particles, and those particles have subatomic particles, and so's my husband. Could my subatomic particles somehow be entangled with my husband's, even if he's far away?
Almost certainly, yes. In fact, almost certainly there are particles in your body that are entangled with some particles in his body. And there are particles in your body that are entangled with the car that you drive, with the kitchen.
So what about, remember when a lot of New Age thinkers began kind of jumping on the idea of entanglement to say, finally, there's scientific backing for telepathy and other psychic phenomena? Do they have a point?
You know, and a lot of scientists jumped on that bandwagon too in the 60s, let's say. But here's the thing. We need locality. We need the non-locality somehow to give rise to the space that we live in. And that's the space in which our consciousness, our brains, our minds inhabit as well. So there can't be psychic phenomena because connections have to essentially be broken to give rise to us. So it's kind of a catch-22 situation. You'd sure like to be able to tell the future or, you know, levitate or whatever, but to have those powers would mean that the very precondition of your own existence would be undermined.
So my last question, you've spent a lot of time thinking about and exploring all these ideas that we've been talking about. Has anything changed for you in sort of the way you see the nature of reality at a kind of felt sense?
I mean, I've always been struck my whole life by the weirdness of space. I mean, forget the phenomena that we deem to be, quote, weird, unquote, such as entanglement or dark energy or the Big Bang. Forget these huge mysteries and just think of the simple things in life, like space. How is it that we can stretch a measuring tape across a room? How is it that we can have a shape? So I think in working on this project, I came to really appreciate the simple things, the things that we don't think are mysteries but are. We don't know why the world is spatial, which is the most fundamental property that it has. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's just like you don't have to jump to the mystery. You just look around you, and you will be led by the nose to the mystery. The mystery is just around us all the time.
George Musser is a contributing editor for Scientific American, and he's the author of a book about quantum physics. It's called Spooky Action at a Distance.